Nebisim moves us forward in time. He was born approximately the year 1310, the year that Rabbi Ibn Aderet passed away. His father was named Reuven. His father was Rabbi Reuven Girondi of Girona. I don't know his mother's name. It's unclear if he was born in Girona or if he was born in Barcelona, but we know that his career is in Barcelona, Rabbeinu Nissim. He's in Barcelona by the year 1336. That's the year he donates a Torah scroll to a synagogue there. He was influenced by Rashba, by Rabbi Ibn Aderet. He learned mainly from his father, his own father, not Rabbi Ibn Aderet's father, and a rabbi known as Rabbi Peretz HaKohen. He was also secularly educated. He served as the physician to the king, as well as members of the royal court, Prince Juan, Prince Alfonso, the Countess of Luna. In terms of his own family, the only thing I know is that he produced two sons. I don't have any other information about marriages and so on. As a Torah scholar, he was a great authority in Jewish law, not as broad in his influence as Rabbi Ibn Aderet, but questions were sent to him from Israel, and he wrote a lot. He wrote on the Talmud. He wrote on the work of Rabbi Yitzhak Alfasi. Rabbi Yitzhak Alfasi was a leading scholar on the Talmud who lived in Fez. Started out in Spain, ended up in Fez, in Morocco. He wrote about Rabbi Alfasi's work. He wrote what we're going to see a lot of, drashot, homiletics, speeches. He wrote poetry. He wrote some biblical commentary. He is considered very creative and original. Take a look on your sheet at source number 10. That's the first one under Rabbi Nissim of Girona. You see that? Girona can be spelled G-E or G-I. By the way, you see it both ways. Professor Warren Harvey is a scholar of Rabbeinu Nissim. And in this essay, Rabbi Nissim of Girona, on the constitutional power of the sovereign, he says, of all medieval Jewish philosophers after Maimonides, the one whose legal thinking is most constitutional, meaning thinking in terms of government and of the systems of government, the one who was most oriented that way was Rabbi Nissim ben Reuven of Girona, known by the acronym RAN. RAN stands for Rabbeinu Nissim. RAN was the leading authority of his day in rabbinic law, and the most original Jewish political philosopher, there's a niche for you, between Maimonides and Rabbanel. Maimonides wrote also politically about structure of government. Abarbanel, who was involved in government, we learned about him last June, also very invested in government and talked a lot about it. Rabbeinu Nissim is the most original Jewish political philosopher along the way, in that period which lasts 500 years, give or take, 400 years. And that's what I want to talk about, is that original political thought, because it's fascinating. Just to round out his intellectual picture, he was an anti-mystic. He did not believe in mysticism. And his students, his two main students who become very well known, are Rabbi Yitzchak ben Sheshet, also known as Rivash, and Rabbi Chasdai Kreshkish, whose claim to fame, I always like to point out, is that he predicted the existence of an extraterrestrial intelligent life. That's a session in its own right sometime. Rose, yes?
Just something small. I just want to say that Nissim is a very Sephardic name. Mm-hmm. I mean, my grandfather was Sephardic. Was Nissim, like Nisei Chasdai. I mean, these are names that are very, very Sephardic.
Oh, yes. He's living in Sfarad. He's living in Spain. So, yes. Interestingly, he never took a formal rabbinic position. He's still considered the greatest communal leader in Barcelona in that generation. But he didn't have a formal position. He was a physician. He gets a lot of respect from non-Jewish leaders. The government consistently sent him cases to judge that involved Jews. The government turned to him to resolve them. The Black Plague hit Aragon in 1348, 1349, and that really weakened the political standing of the Jews there, but they remained free to live as Jews, and Ran, Rabbeinu Nissim, was very influential. He himself, though, was in jail twice, not because of problems with the non-Jewish community, but because of problems with, surprise, the Jewish community. There were wealthy figures within the community who did not like him because he didn't necessarily rule in their favor in their legal battles. We know that in the year 1367, 1368, they made false reports against him as well as six other people. We don't know the details of it except that he was jailed for a while and then freed. And then it happened again in 1370 to him and to a student of his. They didn't like him so much. He lives until 1380. He passes away in 1380. So let's talk about his political philosophy, because that's really what we're here for. I want to begin with a problem, and it's familiar to some of you. Take a look at source number 11, verse in Genesis chapter 35, sentence 11. Actually, before we even see that verse, let me ask you what you think. What would you think is the ideal form of government from a Jewish perspective? Thinking through what you know about traditional Judaism, what would you think is the ideal form of government?
You mean the non-Jewish government?
Sorry?
Do you mean the non-Jewish government or Jews governing within ourselves?
No, Jewish government. If we had our own country, we do have our own country. When we have our own country, and we decide that we're going to follow Jewish law, what should we set up as our form of government?
A Sanhedrin.
Sanhedrin, Diane says. The judges run the country. Seriously?
A dictatorship.
You know, Rabbi Akiva. Sorry, Abram? Abe?
A dictatorship.
Dictatorship. Now we're talking. So, Diane, Rabbi Akiva told his son, don't live in a city if the head of the city is a Talmud Chacham, is a Torah scholar. So I'm not so sure you really want 71 of them to be running your city. Talk about herding cats.
They're all men for sure.
That's for sure. So it's interesting. People usually say monarchy is assumed to be so because you think of King David and King Solomon and so on. That's not so clear cut. And that's what we're going to see here. Sorry, Paul, what?
God as sovereign.
God as sovereign. Excellent. So prophecy, getting messages from God. God says trash day shall be Mondays every other week. So says the prophet today. So if you take a look, except some weeks it'll be pushed off to Tuesday because of a statutory holiday. If you take a look at source number 11, you find a prediction that in fact there will be kings. God says to Jacob, I am God, Shakai, one of the names of God, bear fruit and multiply. A nation and a community of nations will emerge from you, and kings will emerge from your loins. You will have descendants who will be kings. So at that point you know that there are supposed to be kings. Now take a look at source number 12, please. From Deuteronomy chapter 17. When, after you have entered the land that the Lord your God has assigned to you, and taken possession of it, and settled in it, you decide, I will set a king over me, as do all the nations about me. So once you're in the land, and you say, I am going to have a king, because, hey, everybody else does. All the cool nations have kings, so we should have them also. You shall be free to set a king over yourself, one chosen by the Lord your God. Be sure to set as king over yourself one of your own people. You must not set a foreigner over you, one who is not your kinsman, right? Something that has made it into many nations as their policy as well, fear of an outsider taking over. Moreover, he shall not keep many horses or send people back to Egypt to add to his horses. Since the Lord has warned you, you must not go back that way again. I note, by the way, this is, other than one key word, the JPS translation. You could argue with a lot of these translations, but I'm going with it because the crux of it is what is solid. He shall not have many wives, lest his heart go astray. That's its own discussion. Nor shall he amass silver and gold to excess. When he is seated on his royal throne, he shall have a copy of this teaching, the Torah, written for him on a scroll by the Levitical priests. Let it remain with him and let him read in it all his life, so that he may learn to revere the Lord his God, to observe faithfully every word of this teaching as well as these laws. Thus he will not act haughtily toward his fellows or deviate from the instruction to the right or to the left, to the end that he and his descendants may reign long in the midst of Israel. That's the portion about the king, except that I changed one word from their translation. The word in Hebrew, it's part of Mishpat HaMelech, that and Shmuel Aleph Parakhet. You are correct.
Teach us that,
yeah.
That was only if we needed a king, but God wasn't pro-king.
So that's the question.
We're talking about pro-king when we learned that this is only if you demand a king.
So the key is this, literally. The Hebrew word that begins this line is the word key. Ki tavo el haaretz. JPS, in their translation, translate the word ki as if, not when. If you entered the land and you decided you want to have a king, here is how you shall do it. However, that's not usually the meaning of the word ki. Ki has many meanings, but the standard one is when. You enter the land. There's also because, but it doesn't fit in this context. When you've entered the land and you decide. So the question that you have to ask now is, are Jews supposed to have kings or not? If you read the line as if you enter the land and want a king, here's what you do, then it sounds like you don't necessarily have a king. Maybe no monarchy for Jews. If you read it as when, then it's a statement of you're going to have a king. This is confusing. And then you take a look at source number 13. Source number 13 is when the Jews finally decided they wanted a king. They have been in the land for centuries before that happens. First they're led by Joshua, then they're led by elders, then they're led by the Shoftim, who are a motley crew of judges slash leaders of different kinds. Then you get this, source number 13, Shmuel Aleph, Samuel 1, chapter 8. All the elders of Israel assembled and came to Samuel at Ramah, which is where Samuel lived. And they said to him, you have grown old, which I have to say, that's a really nice way to begin the conversation. Nonetheless, you've grown old, your sons have not followed your ways. They're not going to be the next prophets and judges. That ain't happening. Therefore, appoint a king for us to govern us like all other nations. Which is almost a direct quote from source number 12. Right? They are saying what God said they were going to say one day. Samuel was displeased that they said, give us a king to govern us. He doesn't like this. Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord replied to Samuel, heed the demand of the people in everything they say to you. For it's not you they've rejected. It's me they have rejected as their king. It's not you, it's me. So, there's a lot going on here. But let me ask you, based on Samuel's reaction, are we supposed to have a king or not?
Mm-hmm. God interceded, said, look, they don't want me. Well, give them a king and see how well they like it.
Okay. So Samuel thinks no king. Shouldn't have a king. No king. Janine, you were going to say?
I think it's just a grudging acceptance because Hashem said, okay, we'll let you do it. But it's not an ideal.
Right, so Samuel doesn't want one, God doesn't really want one, this is not an ideal, this is not the way it's supposed to be. That's certainly one way.
Right. That's suspect.
Right. to be right, that there is this. Well, that leads us into another approach. What you just said at the end, Janine, leads us in a different direction, which is, it's not that having a king is bad. The Torah does account for it, but it's all in the way you do it. And their request betrays a problem. First problem right away is that you're requesting a king while Samuel is still alive. Right? Which may be smart, because you don't want to wait until there's chaos after his time. But it's a little bit insulting there. One problem is Samuel is still alive. But another problem is what Janine points out, which is the text says, we want a king like everybody else. That's not the reason to want a king. The reason to want a king is so that the nation will govern itself well and do the things they're supposed to do. You want somebody who's going to help the nation stay in line. So, you know, or he's going to defend the population. Right? That's always, you know, sort of job one in modern government is supposed to be to defend your population from threats. So saying saying we want it for this reason may be a problem. Well, Rabbeinu Nissim, in his 11th homiletic, his 11th drasha, gives us a way to look at what was wrong with their request for a king. And it wasn't having a king is bad. It's the way they wanted it. And what he outlines, living in 14th century Spain, is a system of constitutional government, constitutional monarchy, complete with three branches and checks and balances. It's a fascinating system, and that's what I hope to show you next week. So today we saw Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet. We saw the conservatism that he brings to the table in the face of the challenges, external and internal, that the Jewish community is facing in his time. We saw him debating Christians, even if he calls them Ishmaelites. We saw him fighting internal battles in terms of ethics, in terms of adherence to the law, in terms of philosophy, in terms of messianism. And then we switched over and we talked about Rabbeinu Nissim, got a little biography, and introduced the thought that I want to hit next week, which is his theory of how government is supposed to work. And it's really remarkable to read in somebody from his day. And what we'll do next week, God willing, is learn that from his thought, and then also study Rabbi Yosef Albo, who is two generations later, and his theory about faith, about what it is that a Jew is supposed to believe. I'm going to stay on for a few minutes, as always, but I don't want to hold people late. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah.